I'd like to thank the organizers for this opportunity. I actually had no idea what to do and how this talk should be put together, but I hope it will serve at least remember a couple of things that may help us in our future interactions. This talk is, I happen to have taken a talk that I gave the Jackson's Lab Bar Harbor Cancer Course. It's been going on since 1955, and I gave a lecture there last year, and it's part of that which I expanded to combine with another talk which I usually give to students in high school. It is not an insult of the intelligence, because mathematicians are obviously, to me, the smartest people around. But anyway, this talk I gave in Bar Harbor, which the first was 1955, and I saw a picture of the first one, and there were 15 kids in high school, and three of them went on to win the Nobel Prize. And that's how impressive this course is. It's really meant for people who really want to dwell into it. So I respect the students very much, and I got the feedback last week from my talk, and the worst comment was that this is a total waste of my time. The best comment was this is the talk I've been waiting for all my life. I think it is the best, but I still maybe it still meant that it was so bad. But anyway, let's try to kind of relax and go through. Can I have the lights down, please? To go through some of the points that I'm trying to make, and that is, how can mathematicians help cure cancer? And obviously, I think we have to acknowledge that mathematicians have actually contributed tremendously to our understanding of even not only X-rays and other stuff like that, but also like molecular genetics, which Max Del Brook was one of the pioneers. And he was an applied mathematician who went on to win the Nobel Prize in medicine. And it goes without saying that Watson and Crick wouldn't be at all had the opportunity to come up with the double helix if it wasn't for two very skilled mathematically inclined scientists, Rosalind Franklin and Maurice Wilkins, who provided them with the X-ray diffraction. And apparently, if you do look at this, you would actually know the answer, but not me, right? So now, here in Toronto, we also have claimed to fame for having discovered the hematopoietic stem cells by McCullough and Till. And Till was a physicist, and he applied a lot of the mathematical logic to understanding some of the experiments that McCullough, who is a hematologist, were able to show that these little bumps were actually the stem cells of the hematopoietic system, which is capable in one of these cells to generate all the different lymphocytes, as well as other myeloid cells to defend ourselves. Now, the topic I'd like to broach today is cancer. And obviously, we all know now that cancer is the number one cause of death, in spite of the fact that progress has been made tremendously. As of 1935, 80% of the people do not make it after 5 years, whereas today, actually, 36% of the individuals diagnosed with cancers do not make it. And that's it came basically in two steps. The first step mostly in surgery and radiation, and of course that involves mathematicians. But then somewhere in the 50s, we started treating patients with chemotherapeutic agents. And this reminds me of this French playwright who wrote at about 400 years ago that doctors pour drugs, of which they know little, to cure disease, which they know less, into patients, which they know nothing. That hasn't really changed very much, and that's why we're here as scientists to try to change that. Perhaps not the last one, but hopefully a couple of the others. And the basic problem of chemotherapeutic agents, of course, is that it kills not only just the cancer cells, but it also kills normal cells. And here is the number two most used chemotherapeutic agent is still used, is Taxol or Taxotere, and of course it binds to the microtubules, and of course when two cells divide, they actually need these microtubules, and then the Taxol basically interlock so that the cytokinesis cannot proceed in an orderly fashion. So these chemotherapeutic agents have actually served us very well for about 30, 40 years. You can see here cisplatin, which happened to be a magic drug for testicular cancer. You can see the death rate of testicular cancer had basically gone down dramatically, starting from the late 1970s all the way up today. And of course, we know that Lance Armstrong, who actually had testicular cancer and had cancer in his brain, was actually pretty much, I would say, cured today. But that's pretty good. Pancreatic cancer, we basically haven't done anything. 32,000 Americans are diagnosed with pancreatic cancer every year. 32,000 die. So the death rate, obviously, continues as we go into the second phase, where surgery and radiation are guided by very sophisticated kind of like a radiographic a reading as to where the tumors are, and then chemotherapeutic agents basically improve along the way. And of course, again, mathematicians have came to help us understand first the CAT scan, which they went on to win the Nobel Prize, and then the MRI is also another way of imaging these particular tumors. But I think that the field is pretty much clear that chemotherapeutic agent has hit the wall. In fact, no pharmaceutical company I know of today has any program on chemotherapeutic agent. Basically, everyone has gone on to what is called targeted drug. By the way, this is my grandson in San Francisco. So before we really know how to target, we got to know what caused these cancer cells to go went wrong. And so we need to know what the cause of cancer is. In fact, I was surprised that we actually, as scientists in the world, did not know the cause of cancer until 1976. And I came across this in 1966. 12 Nobel Prize winners got together and said, let's find out what cancer is about. And Otto Warburg, who won the Nobel Prize in 1931, actually summarized the meeting saying, well, cancer is not caused by viruses. Cancer is not caused by genes, and in fact, it says that summarized in a few words, cancer is caused by the replacement of respiration of oxygen in normal cells by a fermentation of sugar. And I'll explain to you what he meant. He thought that cancer was due to the inability of our mitochondria to actually use oxygen. And actually, it's now coming back to a point where we have to consider some of his observation. Obviously, he was wrong in the sense that his hypothesis was wrong, but his observation was right. And I think that should be a very nice lead for us to do understand moving forward how to target cancer. Because for many of us, we know that what happened in 1976, Varmus and Bishop in San Francisco discovered that a virus, a chicken virus called SARC or Rouse sarcoma virus, the transforming sequence was, after all, nothing other than a normal sequences of the chicken DNA, and that got mutated because of the mutations that was accumulated, and the mutated cellular gene was able to transform. So that came the proto-virus theory, and today we know that 85% of cancers are basically caused this way, and ironically, we're discovering that more and more cancers are caused by viruses. So the discovery actually found the real reason that cancers went away, and then call these oncogenes. And these oncogenes are genes that are, when mutated or overexpressed, actually cause cancer. And then, of course, there were hundreds and hundreds of them. And in the beginning, there were about half a dozen, then became a dozen, and now we know hundreds and hundreds of genes, when overexpressed or mutated, can cause cancer. So the early hypothesis that because oncogene caused cancer, that we can now block oncogenes and we can cure cancer was the original impetus for pharmaceutical companies to go in and develop small molecules to block these oncogenes. And the supposition was, I guess, pretty much logical. And there was no reason for us actually to doubt that. The idea, of course, is that chemotherapeutic that mutations in normal cells started the mutations which affect the cellular processes of cell device division being stopped and not stopped, or the DNA repair, or the cell's tendency to call themselves abandon ship or apoptosis was impaired, and each of these mutations add to the final demise of the cancer. And because chemotherapeutic agent hit both normal cells and cancer cells, you can only give so much. And obviously, if we give enough chemotherapeutic agents, we will cure all cancers. But unfortunately, the patients will die before then. Now, so these sharpshooting drugs were supposed to come in and that mainly only target the cancer cells, giving you what is called a better therapeutic index, and you could perhaps get away with more of it. And so these targeted drugs is where we are today, and every pharmaceutical company is only working on targeted drugs, and we are basically only researching onto the possible targets that can help us. Now, you can be very sophisticated. You can spend billions of dollars, or you can be very smart. And here is Zhu Chen from China, and this was, we're talking about not China today, we're talking about China 30 years ago. And he discovered that acute promyelocytic leukemia can be treated by all-transnodic acid, which helps the acute promyelocytic leukemia to actually differentiate into terminal granulocytes. And through some Chinese herbal medicine from northeast of China, which the herbal doctors have been able to tell the rest of the doctors in China, every now and then one patient will respond to a particular herb in a very, very dramatic way. And the reason was that it was acute promyelocytic leukemia and the active ingredient was arsenic trioxide. And now we know that what used to be everybody would have died within a year, it is now basically 100% cured with this particular combination. And the reason is because this had a translocation of two chromosomes, 15 and 17, which activated the all transferrin acid receptor, and so all transferrin acid can actually induce it. Now, Gleevec is the poster child. It's a kinase inhibitor for chronic myelogenous leukemia or GI stromal cancer, and you can see here that by targeting this particular kinase, you're actually able to shrink the tumor within 6 months to basically are gone, and 90 to 95% of the patients are actually living while still on the drugs. I think for solid tumors, the biggest home run is the discovery of Herceptin, an antibody discovered by Dennis Slamon, one of our collaborators, which able to target a breast cancer which have a particular amplification of the gene HER2 or HER2-new. And because of that and other treatments, the death rate of breast cancer has finally, once and for all, stopped rising but coming down. But of course, the bad news is the incidence is going up. Now, however, general principles should not be based on exceptional cases. These are exceptional cases. After $300 billion and 30 years, pretty much these, what I just told you, are the magic drugs. And the rest are somewhat not really magic. But at the same time, doing some good, but making a lot of money for the pharmaceutical company. An antibody against the epithelial growth factor receptor is able to give lung cancer patients at about 1 year's time survival rate of 31% instead of 22%. And you can see here that by about a year and a half, basically everything got caught up. And Avastin, the number one selling anti-cancer drug from Genentech, is only able to delay what is inevitable by about 3 or 4 months, and here the colon cancer patients. Meanwhile, the incidence of cancer continue to go up, and mortality continue to go up. So how can we work together as experimentalists and biologists with you to try to now help come up with targets that can actually make sure that it will be targeting mainly the cancer cells and not the normal cells, and thereby you can give more of the drug and hope for more of what's going on. Now, on this 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth, we're in an era, unfortunately, of actually testing no hypothesis of new technology. We think we have came full circle. We now know all the genes in humans and mouse, and we have high throughput cancer super signaling centers, genetic tracking centers. You go to every university, every research institute, every cancer center, you see these nanotechnology center, visualization center, microarray center, a lot of these very high power technology with very high powered mathematicians making all kinds of predictions and clusterings and, you know, et cetera. We generate trillions and trillions of data points. We come up with all kinds of relationships between genes. We continue to sequence DNA at an astonishing rate. We have now sequenced almost as many nucleotides as the U.S. government has on debt, which is approximately 15 trillion. And this goes on, and we calculate computer, and we come up with all kinds of diagrams. And then I think we should rethink now. I think we should rethink. Today's scientists, I think, for your benefit, of course, are substituting mathematics for experiments. And they wander off to some equations and equation, eventually build a structure that may have no relations to reality. I'm not saying they're no good, but I think to be realistic, we are all blind people. And I'll tell you why in the next few minutes. We're all blind people feeling a different part of an elephant. Number one, biggest problem is that after 30 years, 80% of the drugs that we have made against cancer is to target oncogenes. Because oncogene cause cancer, you block it, why not? The problem is, oncogenes kill cells. So if oncogene kills cells, why would you block oncogenes? And it's because survival genes are there to prevent oncogenes from killing cells. So well, maybe survival genes is what you're going after. We need to understand the whole elephant. We cannot just have our own small way of understanding. So this is a very beautiful Chinese painting. Okay? Does anybody know the name of this painting? Is it house, river, tree, village, tranquility? It's two swallows. So we perhaps missing the point somewhat. And here is an ex-president of one of our neighbor countries. So we now know all the genes, right? We generate trillions of beta points at one scoop. It only costs $20,000 to decode your whole genome of 3.3 billion base pairs. Soon it will be, your sequence will be in the drugstore. When you go in there and you actually pick up a prescription, your pharmacist will say, I think your doctor overlooked, you are allergic to this drug because it's in your DNA. We can look at all the proteins all at the same time in a single cell. We generate trillions of data. The complexity of the physiology, on the other hand, is overwhelming. Scores of these pathways, which we still haven't understood their relationships, affect the network of signaling pathways that affect cellular processes and cellular processes affect physiology. So as we move forward with very high technology, I think we have to rethink. Now, we still put in our grants and our paper. At the end, taken together, this data suggests that my favorite gene would be an ideal target for anti-cancer therapy. I really don't think we mean it. We're just hoping we get away with it, right? And I'll tell you why. We now know the cancer genome has over 100,000 mutations. We now know there are hundreds of amplifications of genes that have become, instead of two copies, eight copies, 10 copies, hundreds of copies of the same gene. Deletions, there are hundreds in a single patient. Translocations, there could be hundreds or thousands in each one. And of course, epigenetic changes that we can't even study. To give you an example, a paper just came out. Okay, this from a group in Oxford and Nature. They decoded a melanoma patient. And they found in this single patient 33,345 mutations. A single patient. Of which 292 are in the codons. That means the proteins made would be different. They were, however, able to, through very high skilled mathematics and bioinformatics, came up with a very interesting, perhaps obvious answer, that melanoma patients had been exposed to UV light. And that UV light damage was able to be the initiating and maintaining the development of the cancer. Okay, patient number two. Lung cancer patient, 22,910 mutations, of which 134 are encoding sequences, and these mutations have the signature that testify that carcinogens in the tobacco smoke may have contributed, because they analyze the kind of mutations that were being observed. These are heroic efforts. It's soon going to be very easy, but a couple of years ago, this would still cost a couple hundred thousand dollars and a lot of computing to come to where we are. So I think that few new biological paradigms has actually been around for the last two decades, and there is a lot of technology. Some of you have any of you read this book, Blink? Yes. Okay. So Malcolm Gladwell is actually a Canadian. I don't know if you all know that. And he, in this book, was trying to send out the message, the power of thinking without thinking. The book started with a story of Paul Getty Museum, which when it was started in the early 1980s, wanted to acquire some artifacts that they could actually be able to display in this very beautiful setting in Los Angeles. And the story talked about a forged statue, a Kurus, which the Getty Museum had bought from a Swiss agent after extensive scientific analysis showed its authenticity. 16 months of studying by approximately two dozens of professionals, especially chemists and microbiologists, etc. And that a few art experts were able to just merely looking at it determine that it was a fake. Okay. So they were able to understand more about the essence of the statue than the team at Getty Museum was able to understand after 14 months of studying. These are all professors from UCLA and other places. So Gladwell is saying that we often make bad decisions because there is too much information, unable to determine which aspect of the information is actually relevant. And somehow the instinctive thinking that we may have may actually be quenched because we are so focused on the data. And of course, he was stretching the point, but I think we should be thinking about this. And here's another example. This gentleman was actually here in October, and I got his autograph because he was so astonishingly smart. He was an Australian gastroenterologist, and he thought until then we duodenal ulcer was something that we thought was due to stress, particularly if you have a mother who's very controlling, and psychiatrists are always going to be able to make that point. Someone who came in with a duodenal ulcer somehow always had a controlling a mother. If not, then it's his wife or her husband. But he had this instinct that it wasn't. And together with a pathologist by name Warner, they looked at the juice in the stomach of these patients, and they came to the conclusion that there was a bacteria in there, and the bacteria was Helicobacter pylori. And of course, nobody wanted to believe him. Pharmaceutical companies, of course, they were selling billions of dollars of these antacids, tablets, and why would that actually help things? So he decided one day to go home and told his wife. He said, "I'm going upstairs to my room now," and this is a true story. And in this tube is something I think called ulcer, and it's Helicobacter pylori, a bacteria. If I don't wake up in the morning, you should call the police. So he went upstairs and he drank it. And after a couple hours, he was so painful he started to scream. His wife went up. He was almost dying. They sent in the ambulance. They picked him up, and they were able to rescue him. And of course, he went on to win the Nobel Prize, because today we do not treat the duodenal ulcer by cutting off a piece of the stomach. We treat them with a triple combination of antibiotic to remove H. pylori. So now I come to the very end of my talk, to the point which I finally hope that I would deliver to you as a blind person feeling a different part of an elephant. I promise you I will tell you Warburg. Otto Warburg in 1928 came to a very astonishing discovery which we have forgotten, but I would like to think that we would like to go back. So Pasteur, which was even earlier, had said that when cells grow in the absence of oxygen, they tend to give lactate, and that is because of glycolysis, because glucose is being actually metabolized to pyruvate. And that glycolysis generates 2 ATPs, energies. However, when cells have access to oxygen, it does not give lactate, but it gives oxidative phosphorylation. They give you 34 ATPs. Now, this is the level of my math. 34 plus 2 equals 36. Okay. Now, Otto Warburg, in 1928, I didn't read the paper because it was in German. He said that, of course, in the absence of oxygen, cancer cells would do exactly what a normal cell does. But even in the presence of oxygen, cancer cells would do glycolysis, right? So this absolutely doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Right? It basically, paradoxically, makes no sense, because this gives you 2 ATPs, and this gives you 34 ATPs, and cancer cells are more metabolically active, so they need more ATP. But what Warburg was saying, that cancer cells, and that's why he came to the conclusion that reason for cancer to become cancer was it cannot use oxygen, and therefore it gives you 2 ATPs. So that means they forego 34 ATPs even though they need more from a single glucose molecule. Now, he went on to win the Nobel Prize in 1931, right? Now, today, as we now know, these thousands and thousands of mutations in pathways which are so complicated we can't sort out, in perhaps pathways we will never be able to sort out, because they're all intertwined, that there are two fundamental differences in a cancer cell that we perhaps can exploit, and we can perhaps learn from what Warburg saw in 1928, which is that a cancer cell, because the rate at which cancer cells are growing so fast, cannot deliver and give you the blood vessels that would supply what ordinarily every cell needs, oxygen and nutrient. It's very simple. It's all a matter of whether a new subdivision that grows very fast can have enough roads built in time to deliver as the houses are actually being built in a disorderly manner. Okay? And when that's happening, there are several fundamental things that goes that is needed. Number one, cancer cells, because you build a second cell, would need new building blocks. That's obvious, right? Because if your twin brother or your twin sister is building a house next to you, we need an extra sink, we need an extra kitchen, we need an extra bed, we need an extra, everything has to be duplicated. When those everything is duplicated, they generate more heat because you have to saw it, you have electrical, you have soldering, you have chainsaws, you have machines that are demolishing parts of it, right? And it's more energy. You need electricity or you need gas to supply all the energy. So in other words, building blocks, energy, and when you generate so much heat, you need to put out the fire. It seems very simple. But because the mutations are so numerous, we are basically asked to do what ultimately is the most reductionist. And let's now think a little bit about it. The amount of heat a cancer cell generates in the form of reactive oxygen, okay, is enormous, in the order of 100 to 1,000 times more. In other words, instead of having a pilot light in your kitchen, the whole place is actually burning down. And what do? You come in with sprinklers, okay? So what happens is the amount of reactive oxygen to be generated, usually metabolized in the mitochondria. But oncogenes that cause cancer, like RAS and MYC, they generate a lot of reactive oxygen. Hypoxia, because cancer cells live in low oxygen, they still have to make proteins. Making proteins in low oxygen is like putting together a jigsaw puzzle in the dark, because there is not enough oxygen for the cysteine bonds to form disulfide linkages. And as the proteins are being generated in the endoplasmic reticulum, they clog up the whole thing, and more you just make more of the endoplasmic reticulum, you get more. And so this kind of amount of energy and heat will pick the cell and kill the cell by burning the cancer cell down. But since cancer cells that is burnt down will not give you cancer, the only cancer cells that survive to do damage is that they increase the amount of antioxidant. In other words, they put in more sprinklers. And these antioxidants are called NADPH, glutathione, and something that we discovered called DJ1. Okay? And because now you have all these antioxidants, the house is not burning down, then the cancer cell gets to live in a state in which the amount of reactive oxygen is in the middle. Not enough to burn down the house, but yet the whole place have a lot of reactive oxygen. These reactive oxygen are the most mutagenic compounds that you can ever be exposed to. Okay. Bruce Ames spent his whole life, it's the Ames assay, which is a bacteria, which had a reporter testing for mutagens everywhere. At the end of his career, he came to the conclusion that by far the most important mutagen is in your body every day generated by yourself. And what you do being exposed from the outside is somewhat minimal. Okay? Now I'll tell you a story of how we came to this. About 7 or 8 years ago, a German postdoctoral fellow, who's now the head of clinical trials in Novartis, he discovered a gene called DJ1, which opposed a very important tumor suppressor gene in a very important pathway called the PI3 kinase pathway. That gene that caused cancer turned out to be lost in Parkinson. It was PARC7. So when they rushed into, I remember, that morning at 8 o'clock, both Mildred Peters and Raymond Kim, the MD PhD student, rushed in and he said, DJ1 is PARC7. I thought PARC7 is a PARC down the road. It is a 25 kilodalton molecular weight, hooks up itself as a homodimer. And it was PARC7. PARC7 is a gene mutated in Parkinson's disease. And every single individual with the mutation of DJ1 or PARC7 will come down with Parkinson before they are 40 years old. Okay. So what is going on? A gene that causes cancer is lost in Parkinson. What is going on is that the reactive oxygen that are being made in the neurons of our cells, when there is not enough sprinkler, the reactive oxygen will burn down the neurons. When the neurons that make dopamine are killed, you do not make dopamine and you get Parkinson. So DJ1 or PARC7 is there to sop up the reactive oxygen. Now, if you sop up too much reactive oxygen, the reactive oxygen doesn't kill the cancer cells. The reactive oxygen then causes cancer. So this is the experiment that he did that actually showed us what was going on. MPTP is a contaminant of opium. And this is the drug that was first tested in man before it was tested in mice. Because people used to do the snorkeling of the opium, and MPTP was a contaminant. And then they shake a few weeks later. And because their dopaminergic neurons, you can see here, has been reduced to the borderline. But if you have no DJ1, it's gone, and you get Parkinson forever, right? Instead of just transiently. And if you have DJ1, you are 2 to 3 times more likely to die in lung cancer. If you have DJ1 and you have ovarian cancer, you are unlikely to live past a few months. And this is not even our work, but work that kind of came out to confirm us, our work. And a Chinese group showed that if you have esophageal cancer with DJ1, you basically died very rapidly. So what we're seeing here all of a sudden is that this reactive oxygen, when there the quenchers, a lot of quenchers to sop up the reactive oxygen, allow the cancer cells to smolder, can develop cancer over time and have bad prognosis. But when it's missing, the reactive oxygen will kill the cells, as in the case in the neurons. So very simply, in the last few minutes, we come back to this problem. So what Warburg said is the cancer cells, instead of getting 34 ATP, only use 2 of them. Which doesn't make sense, because cancer cells need all 34 and many of them. But doctors say, don't worry, because they are consuming a lot of glucose. You can see here, this is the patient with the tumor, And the tumor is consuming a lot of glucose as labeled, and so you can see. So in other words, it's like taking an apple and taking one bite of two ATPs and throwing about 34, but apples are falling through the sky. Okay. However, that theory mandates that you consume your glucose very fast rate. Then you have to eat like this. Right? But a glucose comes in, it loses to ATP to get the fructose 1,6 bisphosphate. And you'd gain back 4 ATPs when phosphoenolpyruvate converted to pyruvate. And there 4 minus 2 equals 2. Okay, this is mathematics at my level. Lou Cantley's group discovered a new form of pyruvate kinase used only by cancer cells called PKM2 instead of PKM1 by normal cells. So that theory would say that PKM2 would be faster than PKM1. That's the only way you can get enough energy, right? Wrong. It turned out the cancer form of pyruvate kinase slowed down glycolysis, which means it's like eating like this. Where is the energy coming from? So the reason they figured it out was that by glucose coming in and then building up a block here, it builds up glucose 6-phosphate. Glucose 6-phosphate goes down the pentose phosphate, which gives you ribose and DNA. So that makes sense. A dividing cancer cell needs DNA and RNA to make the next cell. But cancer cells have excess DNA RNA. So that didn't make sense. It turned out they're going after NADPH. NADPH converts glutathione into glutathione disulfide, and glutathione converts to ROS. Things are pointing out to this ROS problem. By the way, glutathione is 5 to 10%, 10 millimole in your cell. Okay? So it turned out that the only three ways of getting NADPH in a cell, the pentose phosphate shunt, which is used, glutaminolysis, and isocitrate dehydrogenase. Glutaminolysis, when glutamine comes in, glutamate converted to pyruvate gives you NADPH. And we add 100 times more glutamine in our tissue culture when we culture cancer cells. And finally, if you do not believe, NADPH is generated by isocitrate dehydrogenase in the peroxisome. And sure enough, isocitrate dehydrogenase is found mutated in almost every single glioma and secondary glioblastoma. That mutation is completely mutually exclusive with other normal mutations. And this turned out gives you more NADPH. Okay, this is work from our lab that's published. And it gives you a very interesting metabolite and in both gliomas and AML cells, and it gives you NADPH. So I think what we're trying to say is that given the fact that we're having this all this problem with generating, understanding all this mutations, perhaps it boils down to very simple, that oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes mutate to change metabolism. And maybe metabolism is something that we studied 80 years ago that we have forgotten that's important, but it's time maybe we go back. And that these oncogenes, like RAS and PI3 kinase, they activate mTOR. mTOR activates glucose channels, and glucose channel allows glucose to come in. P53, a tumor suppressor gene, activates mitochondrial respiration to prevent glycolysis. So this is perhaps my my part of the elephant as a blind person. So with that, I'd like to thank all these individuals that I mentioned the name. Are the students in here? Yeah? Okay. For the students, please, this is your supervisor. He's going this way. And it doesn't matter because the truck could be coming. But the senior postdoc's ready to go. And the senior students, but perhaps you could, you know, as we said in the early introduction, that